Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sanghaṃ namassāmi. So, good morning, everybody, or good evening, wherever you are. And so, beginning our our new year with the practice of Dhamma, contemplating Dhamma, trying to bring these teachings of truth into our hearts. And so when we, of course, we set that intention, or we have that aspiration of bringing Dhamma into our hearts, and you know, there's always some sort of obstacle or difficulty. And one of the ways that the Buddha, say, described highlighted these things is the taught about the what are called nivarana. These are hindrances, and say a hindrance is something that overwhelms awareness and weakens discernment. So that, or overwhelming mindfulness and weakens our wisdom, and that. is something that happens in meditation. It happens in our daily life. It happens in our interactions with people. It happens when we're by ourselves. These various hindrances arise in the mind, and they overwhelm awareness and weaken discernment. And the Buddha pointed to these hindrances so that we could say more completely understand the obstacles and overcome them. And I think one of the aspects that's important to highlight or to draw attention to is how do we respond to these hindrances? Because oftentimes we'll view them as obstacles, difficulties that we have to, say, fight against. We have to struggle. We have to overcome them. We have to defeat them. And just by saying that, it already sounds very tiring and difficult. So not sort of setting them up as an enemy that we're sort of riding out on our white horses to sort of do battle with. It's more, what are they teaching us? What are we learning from? What's it pointing to that we haven't really understood yet? And so this is, I mean, this is a, it's a way of approaching things that I think is, because sometimes we, especially we think in terms of, you know, I want my peaceful mind, I want concentration, I want my meditation to go well. I've got to get rid of these defilements and then I'll have a peaceful mind. And that, but I think, you know, the Buddha is always trying to get us to step back and look at a bigger picture. And because, again, this sense of, it was mentioned yesterday, how there's sometimes a division conceived of or talked about of a difference between, say, like samatha and vipassana, or developing samadhi and having insight. And there's really, you know, that to me, it's you know, sometimes it can be useful, but it's oftentimes it's a false distinction. And these are always working together. Say, like one of the ways that Ajahn Chah described it is sort of like a, you know, like a fruit is like a, there's a, in the Thai language, you've got different names for mangoes at different stages of ripeness, because you'll use them for different things. But in reality, it's the same mango. But it's just, you know, we tend to put different labels on it. So similarly, say, even like samatha, vipassana, those are, they're names pointing to the same process of the mind that, that we're cultivating in order to free the heart from suffering. And the aspects of insight, understanding, and contemplating, so that we reflect on our experience, is really important. This is also, you know, thinking in terms of, like, one of my previous talks, I talked about right view. And the right view was in that we're the owners of our karma, and which is true, but it's also, say, right view on a conventional level, on a worldly level. Then also the Buddha talked about right view that has a transcendent element that will, that is kind of a liberating right view. And that right view is the right view of the Four Noble Truths. And it isn't as if we these have to work together. They can't, so that by viewing things through the lens of the Four Noble Truths, then we start to look at things in terms of experience or phenomena, as opposed to through the lens of me, self, and the mind, and to a certain degree, I mean, that again, we say, yeah, we're the owners of our karma, but also, even when we are the owners of the of our karma, we don't want to be inserting self or propping up and just reinforcing that sense of I, me, and mine. Looking at things through the lens of experience of, oh, this is dukkha, this is unsatisfactory, this is its cause, this is the cessation, this is path leading to cessation, then we can step back from that self-investment And so that, again, talking about the hindrances, a hindrance comes up either in meditation or daily life. We have some aversion, ill will. We have some desire, dullness. And all of it, very, very quickly, it's me. Me being desirous, me being aversive, me being dull and dim, me being worrying and getting, it's me. It ends up me all the time. And so then, that is a huge hindrance. These hindrances are also how they manifest is we can be using them to recognize what those patterns of mind are that do overwhelm our awareness, overwhelm our mindfulness, and weaken our discernment, our wisdom. And then we can be using the hindrance as a means of working. But it's always helpful to also be stepping back and framing those hindrances from that perspective of the Four Noble Truths experientially, what's happening? What is the experience? And then how do we work with it skillfully in order to, say, lift up and nurture awareness and discernment, our mindfulness and wisdom. So the hindrances sense desire, and that can be desire towards material objects, and be desire sensual desire, seeking gratification through the senses, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, sexual desire, fantasy. It's all sense desire. It's all a desire, and we tend to get stirred up by desire. We tend to get it clouds the mind, and they say that and one of the things that's really interesting in terms of these hindrances is the way that they say the images that the Buddha gives to illustrate the hindrances, so that there's two major kind of sets of similes that the Buddha gives, and one is in terms of water. So that sense desire is like having dye in the water, a colored the water gets colored, or ill will boiling water is boiling, so then it's disturbed. Sloth and torpor is like water that's covered by kind of algae and slime, so you can't really see the water very clearly. Restlessness, worry is like kind of waves or ripples on the water, so it's disturbed. And skeptical doubt as the fifth hindrance is the image is one of water, kind of like muddy, turbid water that's even put in a closet. It's stocked away somewhere. But these images that the Buddha uses are sort of like the underlying thing. It's like water. Its nature is being covered over by the hindrances, and the inherent nature of water is for it to be clear and still. Yeah. So that sense of how we and that's pointing to a certain nature of the mind. When the hindrances are not, say, yeah, overwhelming awareness and weakening discernment, the nature of the mind is to be clear, is to be still, like water that is more in its, say, more in its pure state or clean state. So it's a pointing to the possibility, and which we can keep returning to or keep realizing. And you know, so much of it is just being able to, like, working again, a sense of really, what are these hindrances telling us? What are they trying to teach us? What are they pointing to? What element of suffering is being highlighted, and how to work with it? So then we have to become, say, skillful at working with these hindrances and the counterpoints to hindrances, so that classically with sense desire, then the encouragement to reflect on the body, and the aspects of the non-attractive nature of the body, in the sense that you know, we tend to get swept up, and whether it's our own body, the bodies of others, there are attractions, and then the body is also the vehicle for gratification. It's our sort of body with its senses that we rely on in order to seek out and experience and gratifications of the senses. We go out to see, to hear, to smell, to taste, to touch, so then that's reflections on our own bodies, and our own body is of nature of any other body. And the very first meditation that is given to novices when they take on the novice training is the reflection on the first five of the 32 parts of the body. Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. And you go back and forth reflecting on that. And it's interesting to contemplate in the sense that hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, that's actually all we ever see of anybody else. They're, you know, of course it has all sorts of different configurations into male, female, young or old, large or small, but in the end, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. It's not a big deal. And that is a that's helpful for cooling and sort and settling the mind. It's not a value judgment. It's a sort of it's just the nature of this is what bodies are like. And that's helps to attenuate that tendency of, okay, I'm relying on this body and caught up in its either its health or its acuity of its senses or whatever. And that's helpful. And also just reflecting on the nature of desire, in terms of like sense desire, we seek gratification, we seek pleasure. And who doesn't want to experience pleasure? But it's helpful to reflect on that nature of desire where it's never really fully satisfied. It's never really feels complete in itself. I mean, there's a feeling of lack, which we then try to fulfill through a desired object. And what happens is then the mind looks for something else. That's the nature of desire. It's never really content. So the aspects of the contemplation of contentment is a way of challenging the mind that countering that movement of mind seeking gratification because that sense desire is it's always it's always unfulfilled. And of course, when we reflect in that way, then it tends to highlight or we start to recognize, okay, this is suffering. And it's a, or this is unsatisfactory. This is stress. We're putting stress on the system and being able to work with that. So it's not, again, it's not just sort of pushing away, trying to push away the hindrance so that we don't have a hindrance, but it's more like being willing to listen to that hindrance to say, what is the underlying movement or underlying quality that keeps appearing, and what is and that then that's we're starting to look at it through the lens of the Four Noble Truths, and it becomes a vehicle for both calm and settled still mind and a deeper understanding and deeper discernment of the human predicament and freedom. So so that holds for all of the hindrances, really. The other set of images that the Buddha gives are things in terms of difficulties, so that, say, being trapped and caught by the hindrance of sense desire is like being in debt. So that when one is in debt, one is uncomfortable and we feel vulnerable, we feel oppressed by the debt and the, say, worries and fears of when the person is going to call that debt, or how they're going to do it, that, all of that. That's why I say, like say certainly in America, I think, and they have things like mortgage parties when people finally pay off the house mortgage, and they have a big party because everybody's really happy. I mean, it's fine in the family; they've finally been able to free themselves from that mortgage, that debt, and it's a huge burden lifted off. And that's actually what the Buddha points to in the terms of the result of freeing the mind from the from the hindrance is the result is the experience of joy and happiness. There's joy and happiness that comes from when we're able to release or not be tied to, not be bound up with that sense desire, the hindrance of sense desire, that constant moving to gratification through the senses. There's a joy and happiness that we experience. It's quite a natural and quite a pure experience. So that when these hindrances that say the Buddha points to, say like ill will, aversion, the Buddha says it's like being that anger. What the heck is? Do you remember that? The image for anger. For some reason, it's escaping me. It's illness. So having a fever, fever, and one feels oppressed by having being when we're ill, when we go to fever. It's just a feeling of oppression, and then when the fever breaks or when the illness goes away, there's a relief, a sense of joy and happiness that comes, and the hindrance of sloth and torpor is when we experience sloth and torpor, it's like being in prison, being in jail, and we're confined, and it is it's uncomfortable, it's unpleasant, but when if one is released from prison, released from jail, then there's a sense of joy and happiness and ease that comes from that. It's quite natural. So in the same way, when the mind is actually able to release or not buy into, not get caught within sloth and torpor, then there's a joy and happiness that is quite naturally felt. The hindrance of restlessness and worry, the image that the Buddha gives is one who is in, say, it's like an indentured servant or a slave. One doesn't have the freedom to go where one wants, to work where one wants, do what one wants. One is in servitude to the whims of others, and so then that is oppressive. But when one is freed from that condition, then there is joy and happiness. And it's quite natural. So the mind is similar. When we're able to just allow stillness, contentment, that freedom from restlessness and worry establish itself, there's a deep wellspring of happiness that's there. The hindrance of skeptical doubt is a experienced as, say, one who is having to go on a journey through a desolate area, could be a desert, could be a kind of an area that's really not populated, and is very uncertain whether one is going to where one's going to stay, what one's going to do, is it safe, is it not safe. The mind experiences suffering because of that doubt, but then reaching one's destination, reaching a place of safety, then there's a sense of joy and happiness that arises. So it's in the same way that we're oppressed by skeptical doubt, and when we are able to release those doubts or not buy into those doubts, not even formulate those doubts, this is tremendous sense of joy and happiness. So these are images that are useful for depicting in the same way that, say, the images that the Buddha gives around water that is disturbed by hindrances, but then without the hindrances, then yeah, there's clear and still water. In the mind that is the images that the Buddha uses of the various difficulties and problematic circumstances that arise, then the kind of natural sense of joy and happiness, well-being that comes when we're not overwhelmed by these hindrances. They cease to overwhelm awareness and hamper discernment. So it's an opportunity to remind ourselves to return to this quality of mind, this sort of well-being and clarity that is it's kind of like our birthright, again, as I say, Gajahn Chah said, oh, this is our real home. Learning how to come home. We invest enormous amounts of energy in getting entangled and complicated, and the opportunity to drop that, let it go, establish the mind and the skillfulness of mindfulness and discernment. That is a such a important and worthy goal. So then it's just learning how to work with those hindrances, and as I said, it's like being willing to learn from them, and just not trying to annihilate them, push them away, or ignore them. But when those hindrances are there, they're teaching us areas where we still need to pay attention. We still need to learn. We still need to grow. And so those aspects of, say, yeah, sense desire. Okay, where being able to, can I actually dwell in contentment? You know, what happens when I don't act on trying to gratify some desire. You know, oftentimes we don't think of it because the desires come up, and so it's either we're frustrated that we can't get it, or we just get sort of stirred up and complicated when we do get it. But it's sort of, well, can we actually reflect on, oh, that desire, like a desire pops up in the mind, and if we don't get it, are we actually lacking anything? You know, and it's not like, okay, you know, and it's important to sort of make that distinction between like desire, because we have very ordinary desires that are quite natural, and that are actually quite, say, motivating. Those are skillful. But the sense desire, and that in the technical term, kama chanda, so that desire towards sensuality, sense desire, but so that isn't like, I'm hungry, I desire my breakfast. Like right now for me, it's 6 o'clock, breakfast is at 7. Yeah, it'd be nice to have some breakfast, but it's not time yet. So it's a, it's a desire, but it's not there. It's just sort of, it's ordinary. That desire, I think, well, you know, I don't need to fulfill it. I mean, I'm quite all right. And so that's that sense of that feeling of lack and the desire say, oh, you'll never be happy if you don't get this. And it keeps driving us, keeps moving us. But that if we just investigate, oh, there's a desire actually, I'm fine. That sense of the problem is the sense of lack, and we're always trying to fill. We're always trying to fill that hole, and it's actually not fillable, not through desire. I mean, it's fillable through Dhamma, through contentment, through wisdom and clear seeing. But it's not fillable through the actions of our just following desire. So it's that sense of contemplating fullness, and you know, it's a really interesting contemplation. But then you're starting to look at it through the lens of Four Noble Truths, and then that has a liberating quality. Aversion, ill will, irritation, those can we listen to what is it telling us? And oftentimes we say ill will, aversion, irritation is about I didn't get what I want, or I don't think it is what it should be, and so then there's ill will, aversion, and you know, look, when we look at it through with clarity and we're actually present at that time, then that sense of you know, trying to get the situation to be how one wants it, feeling threatened because we're something is not the way we thought it was going to be or how we thought it should be, then we can give it some space. We can give it some kindness. We can give it some compassion. like responding to those, frustrated desire or frustrated expectation. There's that ability to hold it with kindness and compassion. Then that irritation and aversion, it dissipates. It falls apart. It doesn't even have that food of, and didn't have that kind of that drive behind it of that feeling of me not getting what I want, or me not me having to put up with things that I don't approve of, or don't I don't agree with, or I don't maybe confused by. So then we push back, and just being able to respond with kindness. This is why the classical counterpoint countermeasure for that hindrance of ill will is loving kindness, and it's the traditional way that the Buddha gives an opportunity for resolution, or tool for resolution. So it's something to recognize the quality, loving kindness, compassion, and that has a healing quality. The sense of sloth and torpor, dullness, stiffness of mind. Oftentimes we're, again, looking at it from the what is it pointing to? What is it teaching us? What can we learn from this? And so often what I find for myself that sloth and torpor, that stiffness of mind, oftentimes comes from this is something we experience in meditation. It's also, we can experience it elsewhere. But, oftentimes to me, what it feels like is that, we want to experience a peaceful mind. We want to experience we want to experience stability. And as we start to settle the mind, or even in ordinary day-to-day life, if we're engaging, but certainly in meditation, as we begin to settle, we want that stability to be there, and so that we want to we kind of hold on to that, or we place an expectation on it, or we get drawn into that wish or hope or wanting that to be still, to be stable, and it's like wanting to be reborn in a pleasant realm somewhere that is stable, and we do, and of course that's not possible. And especially in our meditation, when we start to drift into dullness, it tends to be a wanting to, or just expecting that it's going to stay that way. We start to feel a bit comfortable, and then we just want it to be like that. And we don't invest the mindfulness or the lift up the attention so that we can actually adapt or adjust to the natural change that's taking place all the time anyway. So then the mind sinks and you know, sinks into torpor, into stiffness. So, and one of the qualities of say the of samadhi, when the Buddha talks about samadhi, the descriptions, I think I mentioned it, is that kamaniya, that is ready for work, and another was which is it's pliable, and so it's adaptable. It's ready to work. It can adapt and adjust to situations, and that's the function of mindfulness and discernment. When we allow the mind to sink, then, or we invest in that, I just want to be still. I just don't want to have to deal with this. Then we're hindering the mind. We're actually, weakening our own discernment. So it's the hindrance starts to kick in and take over. So it's looking at it from the lens of Four Noble Truths and suffering. The restlessness restlessness, worry. The mind sometimes that's the way the mind works. Looking for something to worry about. Looking for something to think about. Looking for sometimes you have to, it can be irritating to have this restless mind that is always looking, isn't able to settle very much. But, sometimes we have to work with that. We have to learn from that. So sometimes just like listening to what the train of thought is, because the mind does the restlessly think about something. Just listen to a train of thought and then repeat it. I want to go for a walk. And then just to repeat that, I want to go for a walk. For a walk. A walk. A walk. A walk. And pretty soon your mind I just want to put it down. See, it's just, okay, you're ready to put it down when you actually articulate it to yourself. But, when we keep the image that the Buddha gives of the ripples on the surface of the water, it's all on the surface. And if we're willing to sort of not keep buying into or not invest in all that rippling, we say, okay, what's underneath? Then we can actually access the still water that's beneath that. Or using image of water again, sometimes with thoughts, like to imagine that you're writing out that thought on water. And just actually you articulating that whatever restless thought is there, and then as imagining in your mind that you're writing that thought on water. And of course, it's not going to stay there. It's just going to disappear. So it's a helpful way to dissipate that restless mind. Doubt. It's this sense of doubt and uncertainty the Buddha actually says there are things that are worthy of doubt. In the sense of to the Kalamas, And yeah, you're doubting that which is worthy of doubt when there are all these different teachers coming through and giving different teachings, and it was very confusing. But that's not what the Buddha's pointing to. He's pointing to this kind of skeptical doubt, a sense of uncertainty, kind of wavering. Did I get it right? Did I get it wrong? Is this, which one's right? Which one's wrong? And then this mind that's back and forth. And that's where one of the things that I've found really helpful over time working with doubt is just coming back to the body. And that the tendency of the mind, I mean, it's slippery, it's immaterial, but bringing our awareness back into the body, being present in the body, embodying our mindfulness, and then things become a lot more clear. It slows things down, gives a bigger perspective, so that sense of being oftentimes the doubts fall away in the same way that when reaches a place of safety, and that image that the Buddha gives of the traveler going through a desolate area. You're reaching a place of safety, reaching the destination. One can drop the burdens of the journey. So similarly with doubt, that sense of, okay, we can rest in mindful, embodied awareness. We can be present. And because sometimes that helps to actually clarify, well, what's worthy of actually doubting or following through, exploring, trying to figure out. And, you know, there's a lot that's really not necessary. It's just this sense of, yeah, and getting familiar with the, as again, that sense of Ajahn Chah, being the one who knows, being the knowing. That's really a refuge. So as I say, as we say, beginning our day here in North America, or it's still in the day in Europe, or it's ending the day in Asia or Australia, it's like the turning attention to the mind that has hindrances, but then also recognizing that's not the whole picture, and it's not again recognizing that the opportunity that the hindrances are giving us to look at that through the lens of Four Noble Truths rather than me swept up in hindrances again, me being oppressed by hindrances, me being this person who's always falls for hindrances. I mean, we get a story going and we believe it. But it just takes a different view, and yeah, we look at it through the lens of the Four Noble Truths. This is dukkha. This is the cause of dukkha. This is cessation of dukkha. This is path leading to cessation of dukkha. So that we're bringing our practice back to that foundation, and then pulling in our experience of different things so that it helps feed that that perspective or nourish that perspective. So I'll offer that for reflection this morning.
Annamayam Dhammakataya Sadhukaram Dadamase Sadhu 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 Anindotami.
Okay, so we next part of our session is questions and answers, and there's even more questions than there was yesterday, so we'll see how far we get, and and I'll probably skip around, it's like four pages, so I'll skip around here and there and try to do what I can. And then, of course, we'll have another session, say here, later, where I'll continue with the questions. sometimes during meditation, I felt like being in waves, as if I'm moving in a wave motion, but actually my body is still. What does it mean? What should I do when it happens? It means it feels like being in waves. It's you know, oftentimes we tend to, you know, try to interpret so much, or we try to make sense of it so much that we there's so much, how do you say, self involved in that, that is so that is the actual, say, hindrance. And I mean first is to pay attention to in terms of basic feeling tone. Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it neutral? So then one starts to see, this is where you start using, say, like the four foundations of mindfulness as a frame of reference for our experience. And say, this is an example, I don't want to, but I think it's a helpful example in the sense of when we, so like, you know, we interpret it from a personal perspective, and this is me, experience this, what does this mean, what's it say about me, if it's like this, am I a success or am I a failure? Is this good or is it bad? Am I doing it right or am I doing it wrong? You know, those are all kind of underlying assumptions that we, you know, it's easy to get hooked by. And so being able to have a frame of reference, a foundation of mindfulness that we view it through, then we can say it's not picked up as a personal thing. It is, highlighting Four Noble Truths, highlighting dukkha, cause of dukkha, cessation of dukkha, path leading to cessation of dukkha. And that's a step into freedom. So we can view it through the lens of body. Well, what's the actual experience of the body? Where am I experiencing the that feeling of waves? What is it? How does it get experienced within the body? So that's and different ways that we can bring that attention into the body is using, say, body as a, say, kaya anupasana, the body as the foundation of mindfulness, feeling as the foundation of mindfulness, mind as the foundation of mindfulness, in the sense of one is feeling like being a waves, but then does it, because is the mood of the mind one of a greed or desire? Oh, I want more. That feels good. Or is it? It's something of. Oh, there's some kind of. I feel like I'm in waves. There's aversion, ill will. So it's like it's the mind of the mood of aversion, because that's how the Buddha describes, like, mindfulness of the cittanupassana, the mindfulness of the mind. Is the mind, are we experiencing the mind with greed, or the mind without greed? Or is it the mind with aversion, the mind without aversion, mind with delusion, mind without delusion, mind that's contracted, or the mind that's expanded, the mind that is steady, or the mind that is not steady, the mind that's free, the mind that's not free. So those are moods of the mind. So one's exploring it through that lens of the foundation of mindfulness. So it's picking it up in a way that clarifies how we're holding it, and then recognizing, is it a, say, is it, because that's another, say, like in the Dhamma Anupassana, one of the Dhamma Anupassanas, the mindful foundation of mindfulness frame of reference concerning Dhammas, or the objects of mind, is the hindrances. Is it a cause for the hindrances or not? And are there? Can it be used in a way that another aspect of the, say, the frame of reference in Dhammas is the factors of awakening. Oh, can this be used as a factor of awakening? Can I establish mindfulness? Can I investigate Dhamma within this? Can I investigate this experience? Can I bring up a kind of effort that's balancing and settling? Yeah, God, can I experience a sense of joy, well-being, tranquility, stability, equanimity? So then one's using these experiences to pull into Dhamma. And so that's a, it's just a, having a perspective of Dhamma on our experiences is really, especially in terms of meditation, because it's all new territory, and being able to have a sense of a context, so that we're able to use our experience skillfully. (Clears throat) question. Lumpa mentioned about 16 ways of practicing mindfulness when answering one of the questions this morning. Practicing mindfulness of, actually 16 ways of practicing mindfulness of breathing when answering one of the questions this morning. May Lumpa elaborate the 16 ways. That's a whole other talk, actually. So but we'll see. I might maybe the next talk. We'll see. But it is very helpful. This is one in response to a question. Thank you, Bhante, for answering my question about stillness state where no breath is observed during meditation. In clear awareness state at this time, what should we do next? Should we just dwell on the stillness awareness as long as possible, or direct the mind to discern the four foundations of mindfulness, body, feelings, mind, and mind objects? Yes, in the sense that, you know, it's like being, one is just being conscious. Okay, this is still, the mind is it's not thinking, it's still, it's clear. So one can make a conscious choice. Okay, let's deepen that. Let's just settle into that. Let's just run this out, see where it goes. I mean, that's an interesting exploration. How still can I actually get? That's a really interesting, how peaceful can I be? That's a really nice exploration. Okay, the mind is very still. There's a clarity there. Let's turn that to an exploration of the nature of our experience, and turn our attention to the nature of, because one of the things of say that having those four foundations of mindfulness, we're starting to look at things through the lens of certainly of not self. It's not about me and those feelings of I, me, and mine that keep impinging, or oftentimes just kind of reach up from the depths of our being and grab our throats. But it's that sense of four foundations of mindfulness is Dhamma. This is putting in a context of the way things are, looking at things through the lens of, oh, this is not so. These are natural elements. There is this body, there's feelings, there's mind, there's the content of the mind. And they follow a cause and effect process. They have an affect. They create well-being and peace, or they create agitation and distress. What can I learn from that? How can I understand that? How can I let go of that? How can I not be caught and trapped by that? So it's an exploration of insight. And so that those are, we can, it's not that one is right and one is wrong, or one is better, or one is worse. They work together. They support each other. And sometimes we nurture that stillness because there's a kind of a strength or solidity within the heart that comes from that stillness. But we still need to understand, we still need to discern. And that discernment takes an application of the mind. It has to, you know, relies on the it relies on the one. I think there was another question. Okay, greetings, Lopal. This may already have been touched on, but would appreciate further explanation of vitakka and vichara. And that's vitakka and vichara are aspects of thought process, so that the vitakka, Ajahn Jeff translates it, I think, very well. A directed thought, and vichara is examination, so that one directs a thought to a certain theme or object, and then vichara continues to explore that or examine it. And then inevitably that examination will either get sidetracked or distracted or fizzle out, and then we have to direct the thought again. This is part of the thought processes, but it's using the thought processes. And vitakka and vichara can also be, I mean, it can be certainly in meditation and our Dhamma practice, we need to learn how to be skillful. Sometimes it's used as like that vitakka vichara can be misapplied, and then of course we can be directing thought and examining, you know, sense desire and ill will and restlessness. That's not so useful. But it's that directing thought, examination, an old translation was initial thought and sustained thought. And that's that initial thought, and in the sustaining of that thought, the thought process around it, so that especially in meditation, one's learning how to direct that. And then there's different words for like using the thoughts, like one of the enlightenment factors is Dhamma Vichaya. So it's investigation of Dhamma. That's an enlightenment factor. Without that examination of Dhamma, then there tends not to be clarity of understanding. We have to rely on our thought processes to help to clarify. But it's also knowing the balance, and that's where, the 37 Wings to Awakening, there's different sets of teachings, and one of those sets of teachings is the four bases of spiritual success, and the first one being chanda, sort of desire, motivation, interest. I mean, those are different translations. That chanda is its root is desire, but it's one that can be we rely on for motivation and for skills, like dhamma chanda, just desire for dhamma, kusala chanda, desire for the wholesome, for the skillful. So then this, okay, motivation, desire, wirya, so effort. there takes some application of effort. Citta is the same mind, but it's referring to the settling of the mind, the composing of the mind. And then the last quality is, excuse me, is vimamsa. And vimamsa is another word for examination, investigation. It has an implication of reviewing as well. So one is reviewing one's experience because we have to learn from our experience. So this sense of vimamsa, investigating, reviewing. So vitakka vichara. I mean, these are all different words, but I mean, it's the sense of learning how to use the thought process for one's benefit rather than one's for one's detriment. Using the thought process to free the heart from hindrances rather than propping up and feeding the hindrances. So it's a one is using thought process, and vitakka and vichara are an integral part of the thought process. As a way that Ajahn Chah used to talk about vitakka and vichara is like vitakka is the lifting up of the thought. Like we can lift up the thought of the, say, the breath as an object, or lift up the thought of impermanence as a reflection. And then vichara is, it stays with that, it mingles with it, and it looks at it from different angles. So like you're, it's like vitakka is like, this is a clock. So lifting up the clock, and that's lifting up. But then vichara starts looking at it from different angles and seeing it more clearly. You know, but then of course we get bored of this clock and we put it down and we have to lift it up again. So it's and reflect on it. So it's just that process of how we reflect, we think, we examine, we explore our experience using the thought process. And of course, as the more clearly we see things, it's a source of well-being. It's a source of joy and happiness. It's like being able to see this, that's the how the Buddha describes those freedom from the hindrances. We use the that exploration, examination, thought process to see the hindrances and relinquish them. And that relinquishment is a cause for joy and happiness to be experienced. So that is the end of our Q&A session, and we'll meet again later. Another talk, another Q&A session.